brothers took to the skies for the first time in 1903, I think they could hardly have imagined the effects of their actions for the 21st century world in which we live. Millions now rely on the aircraft industry for transportation around the globe. The technology that makes flight possible has actually revolutionized our lives. And I think as Christians, we should be profoundly grateful to God for the tremendous advances human beings have made in technology. Flight's just one example, isn't it? Human beings have shown themselves to be remarkably resourceful and capable of great achievements. But as a result of these wonderful advances, it's now widely believed that we are the masters of our own destinies, that human beings are in charge of the world. We have no need for naive beliefs about God anymore, we think. Because we rule, we think. And yet, for all of our sophistication, we need to acknowledge, don't we, that there is a great evil at loose in our world. The same technology that carries Christian missionaries around the globe was used to murder people on the 11th of September 2001. For those of us who witnessed those images of the planes slamming into the twin towers of the World Trade Center, those images, I think, will be etched on our memories for a lifetime. They highlight for us at the turn of a new millennium that despite our technological advances, evil still abounds in our world. For all our resourcefulness, we seem powerless to deal with the evil inclinations of our own hearts. Well, Hebrews chapter 2, verses 5 to 9, the passage that we're going to look at this morning, addresses this question of who rules the world. And this passage reminds us that it's God's world. It reminds us that human beings are not the ultimate rulers of our world. We actually look after our world for God. He is the master of our destinies. This passage tells us that the future of humanity does not rest on our technological or scientific achievements. It tells us that our fate as human beings turns on the achievement of one man, the man who reigns over God's eternal kingdom. We'll see today from Hebrews 2 that our hope is not in human achievement as we often think. Our hope is not in angels, as the first readers of this letter seem to think. No, our hope is in Jesus, the man who rules over all. Now, as we look at Hebrews, we need to acknowledge that there is a lot that we don't know about the background of this letter. We don't know, for example, who the author of the letter was. We don't know for sure who the recipients were, or where they lived, or exactly what situation they faced. We don't know exactly when the letter was written. There's even some doubt over it being a letter at all. Although Hebrews ends like a letter, you may notice it doesn't begin like one. It may be that this is a series of sermons that's been written up as a letter. So we have to acknowledge that there are some very significant gaps in our understanding of Hebrews. But despite our uncertainties, there is much that we do know from the letter itself. We know that it's a letter written to people who are in danger of turning away from the gospel. That's what we see, isn't it, in chapter 2, verse 1, that passage that we had read earlier and we looked at last week. In chapter 2, verse 1, the author warns his readers against drifting away from Christ, drifting away from the gospel, message that they've heard. Now, most likely, these were Jewish background Christians who were being tempted back into some form of Judaism. But the author wants to show them here that it is total folly to return to Judaism. It's totally foolish to return to Judaism when you have Jesus, because Jesus is the fulfillment of all that has gone before. And so in this letter, the author demonstrates time and time again that Jesus is the greatest. Jesus is the greatest. He's greater than the angels, chapters 1 to 2. He's greater than Moses, chapter 3. He's greater than Joshua and the Old Testament Sabbath rest, chapter 4. He's greater than the Old Testament priesthood, chapters 5 to 8. He's greater than the Old Testament sacrificial system, chapters 9 to 10. You see, the Old Testament contained the shadows, the author tells us. But Jesus is the reality. Jewish religion was empty without the one that it pointed to. Hebrews tells us that God in the past had spoken through the Old Testament prophets, but now God had spoken fully and finally through his Son. Jesus is God's last word to humanity. So in these first two chapters then, the author highlights Jesus' superiority to the angels. Now, what exactly caused these Christians to be obsessed with angels is not altogether clear. But most likely, as alluded to in chapter 2, verse 2, it was their role in giving the law on Mount Sinai that caused them to be particularly revered. Well, we don't know for sure, but whatever the exact situation, the author of Hebrews is adamant here that God's final revelation in Jesus, in the new covenant, takes precedence over a message given through angels, even the covenant made with Moses. And says the author, if God punished those who rejected the first covenant, the one given through angels, how much more will he punish those who reject the message of the new covenant given through his Son? Now, in these first two chapters, the author is trying to accomplish two different things. Chapter 1 demonstrates the superiority of Jesus over the angels because of his deity, because Jesus is God. Chapter 2 demonstrates the superiority of Jesus over the angels because of his humanity, because he's a man. Now, the author has already told his readers that Jesus is the God they must not ignore in chapter 2, verses 1 to 4. But now in chapter 2, verses 5 and following, he tells them that Jesus is the God who shares their humanity. And in the section that we're going to look at today, verses 5 to 9, he shows them that Jesus is the man who rules over all. Well, let's look at the detail together. First of all, the author describes human beings in verses 5 to 8 as the rulers of the world. He describes human beings as the rulers of the world, verses 5 to 8. Let's look at verse 5. For it was not to angels that God subjected the world to come, of which we're speaking. It has been testified somewhere, what is man that you are mindful of him, or the son of man that you care for him? You made him a little lower than the angels. You've crowned him with glory and honor, putting everything in subjection under his feet. Now, in verse 5 here, the author is continuing his argument that Jesus is greater than the angels. It's not to angels, he says, that God subjected the world to come, of which we're speaking. Now, you might be forgiven for wondering where the author of Hebrews has already spoken about the world to come in the first chapter. Certainly, that phrase has not been used in the verses before this. Now, later in Hebrews, the writer will talk about the age to come and the city that's to come, which seem to be parallel ideas. But he seems to imply that he's already been discussing this idea of the world to come. But where? Where is it? Well, although the phrase itself is not used in the first chapter, the idea of the one who rules over the world to come is clearly there. Remember back in Hebrews 1 verse 2, we're told that God has spoken to his people in the last days through his Son. In the last days. And when the New Testament talks about the last days, it's talking about that time between Jesus' first coming and Jesus' second coming. The coming of Jesus 2,000 years ago actually marks the end of history. We now live in the last days. In fact, the era in which we are living in now is seen in biblical thought as the overlap of two ages, the present age and the age to come. See, as Christians, we simultaneously live in the present age that is passing away and the age to come that will last forever. See, in Jesus, we live today as the people of tomorrow. Hebrews 1 verse 3 tells us that Jesus is reigning today at God's right hand. In chapter 1, verse 8, God says to his Son, quoting from Psalm 45, "Your throne, O God, is forever and ever." You see, Jesus has been enthroned as the king over God's eternal kingdom. Hebrews 1, 10 to 12, using words from Psalm 102, has the author speaking of the eternal nature of the Son, and describing him as the one who will transform creation into new creation. And so in chapter 1, the author has already told his readers about the reign of Jesus in the last days over the world to come. But what's particularly interesting in chapter 2, verses 5 to 9, is that it's his humanity that is emphasized here, that Jesus reigns as a man. In verse 6, the author says this: "It has been testified somewhere," which, to be honest, sounds a little vague, doesn't it? It's clearly talking about the Old Testament, but we might wonder whether he's forgotten the reference. In fact, the somewhere is Psalm 8, and the someone who testified was David. But why doesn't the author just say that? We've all been in that situation, haven't we, where we remember some words from the Bible, but we can't quite remember where they are in the Bible and who said them. Is that what's going on here? Well, I don't think so. I don't think for a moment that he has forgotten that these words come from Psalm 8, and that their author is David. If you know this letter well, you will know that this author, whoever he may be of Hebrews, has a remarkable grasp of the Old Testament and how it points to Jesus. In many ways, this letter is a masterclass in biblical theology, in showing how the Old Testament and the New Testament fit together. I wish that we all had this author's understanding of the Old Testament. Now, the reason I think that he doesn't include that information here is because it isn't important to his purpose. Like a good preacher, he's worked out what can be left out of the sermon so that the main point can be clearly heard. But I want you to notice something very important about this quotation in verses 6 to 8 from Psalm 8. I think we're all familiar with Jesus in the Gospels referring to himself as the Son of Man. And so it's tempting to look at the words of this psalm and think that this must also be a reference to Jesus. Now, we'll see in a moment how the author of Hebrews does connect Psalm 8 to Jesus. But we need to realize that we're in danger of misunderstanding this quotation in Hebrews 2 if we jump straight to Jesus. Actually, David is using this phrase in Psalm 8, the Son of Man, to talk about people, to talk about humanity in general. So here, as we read Son of Man or him in this quotation and then on into verse 8, we're meant to think of the human race. We're meant to think of humanity in general. Now, the immediate context of this quotation from Psalm 8 pictures David, the psalmist, examining the night sky. And as he does, he recognizes that human beings are just a tiny part of God's great universe. And David wonders to himself why God would even bother with human beings like him. David knew that God's fingers had created everything. He could see the sun, the moon, the stars, too numerous to count. How could this God, who was so great, how could he be interested in him? Why should this God care about what happens to humanity? But David realizes that God has given human beings dignity and worth. This is what he says. You made him a little lower than the angels. You have crowned him with glory and honor, putting everything in subjection under his feet. See, the only reason that people are significant in such a great universe is that God has placed us in a privileged position. And God has lavished his love upon us. The people of the earth have a status that is just below that of heaven, David recognizes. But people are not important by themselves. They're only important because God has put us in this privileged position. You know, standing alone on a starry night and observing the greatness of creation, the greatness of the universe, the greatness of the Creator, is an amazing cure for arrogance and self-importance. It is tremendously arrogant to think that we can live without God. Because God is the one who has given us everything. He's given us this privileged position to rule over creation because he rules over us. When we lived in Lesotho, we lived in a solid-looking house in a beautiful garden next to the seminary where I lectured. But it wasn't long before we noticed some strange things just after we'd moved into the house. We noticed that there were cracks appearing in the corners of the rooms. In fact, one crack in one of the bedrooms opened up so widely that you could see the garden through the wall without using the window. Then we noticed that the floor was moving. One side of the house seemed to be moving up, whilst the other side of the house seemed to be moving down. And over time, a small step appeared in the middle of our living room floor. Eventually, we spoke to an architect who told us that our house was falling down. They told us it probably wouldn't fall down whilst we lived there, and that was true, but it was just a matter of time. She told us that the problem lay with the foundations. Now, that house is a picture of what has happened to humanity because of sin. In Genesis 3, we see how the foundations of human life have been undermined by sin. It started with Adam and Eve, and it's been continued by us. And we can try to fill in the cracks, and we can try to level the floor, but the truth is, the house is falling down. It's just a matter of time. See, sin has ruined everything, including our God-given duty to rule over creation. See, by nature, we put ourselves first. First before God, first before others. And our actions have badly affected the world that we're meant to rule for God. That's what we see in the second half of verse 8, isn't it? Now, in putting everything in subjection to him, the author says, that is human beings, he left nothing outside his control. At present, we do not yet see everything in subjection to him. In other words, human beings have not lived up to their God-given calling to rule the world for God. We frequently ignore God, the God who has graciously put us in this privileged position. We selfishly abuse our position over creation. We have failed to rule wisely. Under our rule, God's good gifts have become warped by sin. And we've become enslaved by our me-first attitudes. It turns out that we're not the perfect rulers of creation. Many years ago, I lent my bike to someone because I heard that they needed one. For a time, all was well. And then one day, whilst they were riding along, the brake cable snapped. What surprised me, and I must confess, annoyed me, was that this person returned the bike to me still broken so that I could pay for it to be fixed. Now, the illustration's pretty minor in comparison. But God has loaned us his creation as a wonderful place to live. And he's given us strict rules, strict instructions about caring for it and ruling over it for him. Just imagine handing it back to God, having selfishly plundered its resources and destroyed its beauty for our own comfort. Now, I'm not suggesting that environmental care is the gospel, but I do think it's an important implication of the gospel that God's people live responsibly in God's world. You know, sometimes Christians appear to be unmoved by environmental issues. Issues like recycling or pollution or renewable energy. And we sometimes dress up our lack of concern in spiritual language, suggesting that the only thing that really matters is the world to come. But actually, the Bible shows us that we have a duty of care for this world. part of humanity's rebellion against God is their constant abuse of God's creation. And so in this present age, we don't see the perfect rule of man. But there is a man who perfectly rules over all. And Hebrews tells us that his world is coming. So let's look at verse 9, where the author of Hebrews tells us about the ultimate ruler of the world. The ultimate ruler of the world. So where should we look to find the perfect rule of humanity? The end of verse 8 states, "We do not yet see everything in subjection to him," that is human beings, "but we see him." We see Jesus. Jesus is the man who rules the world. He's the man who has succeeded where humanity has failed. He's the one who has rescued people from the scourge of me first. Look at verse 9. "But we see him who for a little while was made lower than the angels, namely Jesus, crowned with glory and honor because of the suffering of death, so that by the grace of God, he might taste death for everyone." This verse is the first time that Jesus has been mentioned by name in Hebrews. Up to this point, he's referred to as God's Son, or God, or the Lord. But here, he's called Jesus, probably to emphasize his humanity. In this verse, the words of Psalm 8 are given a fuller meaning. They're used to describe Jesus' incarnation, Jesus coming to earth as a human being, and his subsequent exaltation. So in becoming human, and especially in his suffering and his death, Jesus, for a little while, was made lower than the angels, even though he's the God of heaven. Jesus temporarily entered into our world so that he could save us from the worst part of who we are. And saving us involved becoming like us, suffering death for us, standing in our place. See, for a while, Jesus seemed less than the angels. But that is not where Jesus is now. Jesus is not on the cross. He's not in the grave. Jesus has been exalted to God's right hand, and he is now crowned, we're told here, with glory and honor because of his death on our behalf. Jesus, the perfect man, now rules over creation from heaven. And one day, his perfect rule will come to earth, and God's people will reign with him over a renewed creation for eternity. You see, it's not us who have the ultimate right to rule. It's Jesus. And notice that the purpose of Jesus' incarnation was to demonstrate the grace of God, we're told here, by tasting death for everyone. The baby born in Bethlehem came to die. He came to show God's unimaginable love for the undeserving. This one who is now crowned with glory and honor was once crowned with thorns. When the author speaks here about Jesus tasting death, he doesn't mean that Jesus only sampled it. We sometimes talk, don't we, about having a taste of cake. You know, can't manage a full slice. We only just want a taste. Now, why anyone would want to do that beats me. But that's not what this word means in this verse. It doesn't imply just a crumb or just a sip, a less than complete experience of something. No, the word for tasting in the original Greek was a common metaphor for knowing something by experience. Jesus did not have a partial experience of death. He drank down the whole cup of God's anger. The whole cup. There was no other way. It was him for us that day on the cross. He was abandoned so that we might never be abandoned. He took our punishment. He suffered our hell. And notice that he did it for everyone. One for the many, for people from different walks of life, from different backgrounds, from different nationalities and tribal groups. And his death has achieved eternal life for those who put their faith in this suffering, dying man. Hebrews 2 goes on to describe how this man, now glorified, has brought many sons and daughters to glory. I wonder, do you really understand how much God loves you? Do you recognize the difference that God's grace makes in your life? That there will be days, maybe even this week, when we are tempted to doubt God's love for us. When we question his goodness. When we question his providential care. But when those days come, and they will come, the Bible calls us to consider the one who for a little while was made lower than the angels. To think about the one who gave his everything for us. The one whose secret mission was to die in our place. The Bible calls us to remember the flogging and the spitting, the nails and the wood, the darkness and the agony of the man on the cross. And as we consider Jesus, we must doubt his love no more. Ultimately, you see, it's not human beings in a general sense that have everything under their feet, that rule over creation. It is one man, Jesus. He's the one whom God appointed heir of all things, we're told in Hebrews 1, who is now at the right hand of God, who reigns over the world to come. And he is the one who has defeated the power of sin at the cross. And one day will have the final victory over all that is evil. Hebrews 1 verse 13 tells us that it's not just creation that God has placed under Jesus' feet, but one day all of Christ's enemies will be a footstool for his feet. The God who took on our human frailty will one day return in divine victory as the perfect ruler of all. And then, only then, will the work of saving his people from sin that he began on the cross be completed. And Jesus will reign over a renewed humanity and a renewed creation forever and ever. Jesus is the man who rules over all. Amen.